Welcome back to Conversations with Conrad. In our second episode this week, I'm continuing the conversation with Brooke about the book Raising Human Beings by Dr. Ross Green. Okay. Let's talk about Dr. Green's assertion that the most crucial task of a child's development is to discover who they are. What do you think he means by that?
That's a great question. So I think what Dr. Green means by that is that a parent should really be looking for having influence but not control over their child, so that their child is free to discover their interests and values on their own, but still within the parameters of a parent's, you know, general rules and, of course, their moral compass.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It goes back to that partnership thing, right? It's about how you need to see your child for who they are and work with that as a partner rather than try to be the dictator of who they are or who you want them to be. It's really interesting. Absolutely. How do you see that working at home?
So a couple thoughts on this. I think that when it comes to how you parent at home in regards to this modality, you really have to think about setting limits in teachable ways. So what I mean by that is a lot of times you'll hear parents, you know, say no, and kids will say, well, why? And parents will say, well, because I said so, and I'm the boss, right? And I think that that can be the most infuriating response to get when you're a child and you're desperately trying to learn about your world and you're not getting any information. So I think that, you know, when parents set limits in teachable ways, what they need to do is not just say, because I said so, but instead say, I'm doing this because I'm trying to help you learn a lesson, a valuable lesson about life to keep you safe, or, you know, to help you learn the difference between right and wrong. You know, so an example of that would be, let's say a brother hits his little sister and then the parent says, don't do that. And the brother says, well, why? She was mean to me. And then, you know, the parent has to say, well, because you're hurting your sister. See, she's crying and it's not nice to physically hurt other humans. How would you feel, right, if someone were to hit you? And then that is therefore a teachable way to set some limits. So the other piece of this, of course, is once you establish these boundaries and these rules and you really elaborate on kind of why they're in place, the next piece is the self-discovery piece, which I love. So as a parent, you can guide your child towards, you know, their possible interests or opportunities to discover their interests without forcing them to like those things. So what I mean by that is, you know, maybe you take them to a field and you give them a basketball, a baseball, a soccer ball, and a lacrosse stick. Then you just sit back and watch what they choose. If they seem to genuinely enjoy one of the balls that they pick up, then there you go. You have gently guided them to discover their own interests without forcing them to do what you want them to do. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. And more importantly, that's how Dr. Green wants you to help your child learn to discover who they are without using force or control.
Yeah, I really like that. The idea of setting limits so children know what's right and what's wrong. And then, you know, the next step, and I think we discuss this a lot more throughout the book, is if they continue to do what they know is wrong, that becomes an unsolved problem.
Yes.
And addressing it from that lens rather than saying it's just a misbehavior or they're choosing to do it.
Right. And yes, definitely. That's when you realize that they're missing some skills and you have to help them build those skills versus just labeling them as being misbehaved. Definitely.
I love your analogy of the sports. How do you see, you know, being able to choose different sports or having affinity to different types of balls or rackets or whatever? How do you see that happening at Bay Farm in the classroom?
That's another great question. So I think that when you watch the teachers in the toddler house or the children's house, one of the things that I love is that a Montessori teacher in those classrooms, they guide children towards works in the same way that parents, you know, can give their kids a selection of different types of balls. And then they sit back and watch to see what the child chooses. So, you know, when a child is new to the toddler classroom and then eventually the children's house classroom, the teacher will, of course, label the different corners of the classroom and say, you can choose from, you know, the sensorial section or the math section. But then once the child knows what each section is, they then come back to that question and say, well, you can choose, what would you like to do? And then they watch and see what the child gravitates towards. And I think that also is a really beautiful thing because, again, you're not using force or control. You know, in thinking about how teachers set limits compared to the way adults set limits, I thought a lot about this. And what I realized is that a teacher is still responsible, of course, for teaching academic subjects. So the only time that a teacher tells a student what they need to do is when they have to teach them an academic lesson based on the age the child is and what they are ready to learn next, right? But besides that, again, the child is still free to choose what they want to do in the classroom after those lessons. So I really just think that Dr. Green's philosophy is so much so in line with the Montessori philosophy in that way.
Yeah, I love that. A lot of schools, it feels to me, focus on kids' weaknesses and strengthening weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I've always thought that schools should spend at least as much time, if not more, strengthening strengths.
Yes, I think that's a great point. And I think the only way to identify strengths is to allow children to have the freedom of exploration so that you can really see what they gravitate towards and then what they're good at. And you can build on that. But the only way to really understand what they love is to watch them closely and figure out, you know, what subject areas they enjoy more.
Yeah. And I mean, from an adult's perspective, I don't spend a whole lot of time doing things I'm not good at.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in school, I feel like we really, really work kids pretty hard on the things that they are weak on. So very, very interesting to look at it from a different perspective. So you do all this stuff and you really set about trying to help your child discover who they are, be a guide rather than a director, but there's still going to be problems, mm-hmm. right? How do you see, I think one of the big issues that arise when problems happen in school or in families is this balance of power.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, a parent or a teacher feels like their power has been undermined, or the child feels like they don't have enough power. How do you see our over-reliance on power working out in controlling, solving problems?
So that's a tough one. I feel that it's really important for adults to remember that power and control is not always the answer. And I think that historically in the world, since the beginning of time, humans have kind of fallen back on power and control as a means to get what they need. And I think that, you know, when it comes to parenting, it's this age-old philosophy that, you know, it's so much easier to just to have the mentality of do as I say or else I'm in control because I'm the bigger person. And that's worked for years until it really hasn't. And I think that people are really uncomfortable with this idea, especially, you know, adults in the older generation, because they're so used to, you know, thinking in this way. But if we can break free from this idea that power and control are the things that get us what we want and what we need, and we're more open to having collaborative conversations with others to solve problems, then that's wonderful. The problem, though, is I think that, again, adults and teachers have to realize that it's okay if they don't have all of that control, and they should adapt this personality, this kind of curious personality when it comes to solving problems and speaking with kids, instead of just telling them what to do again and again and again and getting more and more frustrated when what they're asking of the child isn't happening, but they're not talking to the child to determine what really is going on for them.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I think about how in a lot of cultures, children should be seen and not heard.
Yes.
Or the best compliment you can get from a grandparent is how well-behaved your child is.
Definitely. Mm-hmm.
And that all reflects on, in some ways, the control that you have over your child.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been praised in our culture, I think, to show that you have control. They behave when I tell them to behave. They eat when I tell them to eat. They're quiet when I tell them to be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And while it is important for children to be compliant and do as their parents ask them,
right.
It's much more of a compliment to, being well behaved is pretty low bar with regards to a compliment for a child. Curious is a much better compliment, or how intelligent, or how
mm-hmm.
how good they are at conversing, those
mm-hmm.
sort of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like that, as a culture, we sort of put an emphasis on, the mark of a good parent is how well they control their child.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then the other piece for me, from an education perspective, is that we traditionally through school exert all of these controls on our students, from itty bitty babies all the way through college. And that control starts to, as the kids get older, be reflected in grade point averages and grades.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden they graduate and nobody's controlling them. They're not working for an A. They're not working for an approval. They're not working for and they have a hard time just figuring out what to do because they've not built the interior sort of structure to propel themselves forward. So it's really, really interesting. One of the ideas that I love about this book and about Montessori is that kids aren't lumps of clay that we mold into the vision we have for them, and the acknowledgement that we need to help create, that we don't have that much power. Seeing your child's seeing your child struggle isn't fun. The trick is knowing and when and if to help them.
Right.
And that balance is just a hard thing to do as a parent and as a teacher.
It is. And, that makes me think of just my own personal framework that I follow when I meet with kids here at school. This is in line with the Montessori philosophy, which is why this book, was so profound for me, because it just added to the work that I was already doing with the kids. And so what I mean by that is, when I have my first meeting with a new student that I'm working with, I typically will start the meeting by saying, I want you to know that I believe that you are the expert on you and I am not the expert on you. And even as well as I come to know you, I still will never be the expert on you because I'm not you. And so I'm saying this because I want you to know that I trust that you will help me to help you. And what that really means is, the child and I work hard to explore what it is that the child is struggling with, truly, what skills are they missing, so that I can guide them, but not force my influence upon them or force them to work on goals that I personally think they should work on based on my opinion of them, because that isn't fair. What's fair is what the child identifies, and that can take some pretty hard work, just having conversations around trying to figure out what it is that the child is struggling with can be hard. Some kids are more aware of their deficits than others. So we reach those goals in a much faster fashion, but other kids really struggle and they don't know how to find them. And so that's where I really feel that Dr. Green's methods that he describes later in the book about exactly how to have those collaborative conversations with kids are crucial to my work, because he really gives you the sentences, the words that you can use to get kids to open up and build that self-awareness.
Absolutely. I as a child, I may have made a few mistakes every once in a while, and I always remember the adult in the situation, the first thing they would say is, "Why did you do that?"
Right. Yeah,
and as a 7-year-old, 8-year-old, 12-year-old, I don't know the answer to that.
Right.
And so the response would be, "I don't know."
Mm-hmm.
And that response would be interpreted as, "I don't care."
Mm-hmm.
And then it just becomes this terrible cycle of you do something wrong, I don't know why I'm doing it wrong. I don't have those skills yet. I can't say, well, it's because I have this this lagging skill of self-control, or I'm too young to be able to do that. But still, somebody, and I hear teachers do it all the time, why did you do that?
Mm-hmm.
I find that to be just something that's sort of it is in conflict with sort of helping a child solve a problem. He talks about the helper, and I love his three pieces about the helper. The first job of the helper is not to make things worse, right? That should be clear to everybody, but
right.
that's the first job. If you're trying to help, don't make things worse. The next one is don't take things personally. And that is a very challenging thing to do because, you know, even with a baby, you can take things personally. Just a look or a shrug or, you know, if they don't put their arms out to hug you, you can take that personally. Right. And it's very hard to extract yourself from that. And then the third is promote independence. And I like that because it shows trust that the child has the skills and the ability and the worth to do things themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I think this makes me think of, and I'm sure you might know a few people like this. I think everyone knows a few people like this, but I think that a lot, some adults in particular, feel like the more they say, the more effective they are, right? The more control they have, the more they try to force their influence on someone by saying a lot and giving a lot of ideas or suggestions or advice, then therefore the more successful they are. And I actually disagree with that mentality. I think the opposite is true. I think that sometimes the less you say, the more powerful or profound your influence is. Because one, if you're not saying as much, it's most likely because you're taking a second to stop and think about what you're going to say. And two, you're also leaving space for discussion and reflection. And those things are really important when it comes to solving problems. Instead of just one person unilaterally taking up all the breathing space and not leaving any room for anyone else to say anything and solve the problem.
I think that is absolutely right. We all tend to over-narrate everything. Mm. And you feel this need inside you to try to explain things in so many different ways, so, you know, why you think the behavior was bad or why they can't do it. And you know if you're standing outside or you can look from above that the child's brain has just gone numb. They're not listening to
you. They've lost you at, you know, the third word.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And that to me is just it's so hard when you're in it, but if you can remove yourself and sort of watch the interaction from above, you can really see how, you know, one or two words, that is the most powerful thing.
It can be.
And creating the space for reflection, mm-hmm. and then the safety for a child to actually speak for themselves.
Right.
That's huge.
Right. Showing a child that you are going to pause and actually inviting them to speak and waiting patiently without jumping in if they don't say something after, you know, 5 seconds, that's huge. And that builds trust. That builds so many different skills, you know, just communication skills, relational skills, trust skills, all of those things.
Right.
That made me think of something else. And I can say from my own space of what I need to work on personally as a counselor, I find that I feel pressure a lot when a teacher will say to me, you know, why do you think they did that? Right. And so then I all of a sudden feel like I'm put in this position where I need to have the correct answer. And so I find myself speculating and then I'm like, wait, what am I doing? I don't even know. We have to ask the child. Right. And I think that my work here as a counselor, when it comes to working with the teachers and really kind of, you know, helping all the staff here learn this Dr. Green's modality, because I know that's our end goal, is to stop in that moment and say, I don't have the answer because I haven't talked to the child. You know, that's a really hard thing to do. And I don't want teachers to look at me and think that she might not be good at what she does because she doesn't know the answer. And maybe she's just, you know, not...
totally understand.
You know what I'm saying?
I totally do. And then there's this pressure to solve problems immediately.
Immediately. Oh, yeah. Like, all the time.
And that it isn't actually... The problem's not really going to go anywhere. You don't need a response from a child right away. You don't need to have an answer right away. The important piece, I think, and it fits really well with Montessori, is the process.
The process, right.
And if you're extinguishing behavior artificially, it's not going to last.
Right. It's hard, though. It's really, I will say, when you think about behavior that's disruptive, which I think that teachers in all of the levels of our school experiences at some point or another, when those behaviors are getting in the way of the class, you know, running peacefully, that's when we, the teacher, myself, you, everyone feels the pressure to have those quick solutions. But then, unfortunately, I think we're actually making it worse because we're jumping in and we're being unilateral and we're really not taking the time that we need to devote to help the child.
Right. Absolutely. So I think that this is a great conversation that we're having. you know, just some closing words. I think one of the things that I also thought was funny, if you find yourself frequently reminding your child to do something, it's not working.
Right.
Yeah. And that to me is really funny. We just have a new puppy member in our family. And this is a 12-week-old German short-haired pointer with a lot of energy. And if you're in this sort of, I don't know, it's like a habit trail. You just keep rolling around saying no, 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 no. That's not a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And so carving out the time to have a different strategy and think, you know, like, reminders aren't working. I told him 100 times to clean up his room and he still didn't clean up his room.
Right.
Well, maybe there's a different way to approach this.
Right. And so when you think about that example, because that's a really good one and a very common one, the question that you should ask yourself as a parent would be, well, hold on a second. Maybe my child is missing the skills that he needs to clean his room. Maybe I've never showed him or someone hasn't showed him how to fold clothes. Or how to, in your head, determine what you're going to do first when you clean, then second, then third. I mean, there are so many different skills that you could probably identify that you need to clean a space. And I think that as parents and adults, we forget that, you know, when we were younger, we learned how to do those skills over time. But we forget that sometimes we have to really guide kids and teach them those skills instead of just saying, go do that because I said so. You know, expecting that they just know how automatically.
Absolutely. It's going to be great. So our next conversation, we'll start to maybe dig into some case studies.
Yes.
Because great. He provides some pretty great, good examples of different interactions between parents and their kids. So I think that's what we'll be moving into for the next edition of our conversation. Thanks, Brooke.
Sounds good. Thank you.